All right, folks, welcome back to the show. We are here today to talk about Society Game, Korean variety shows, The Genius, game design, whatever else takes my guest fancy. And that guest is the one and only Miles Nye, who you will have heard about from his appearances on RJP. You may have heard of his work as a challenge consultant for Survivor. If you follow him on Twitter, you'll be aware of his game design work in a professional capacity. And I'm sure I'm leaving a lot of stuff out there. So, Miles, welcome to the show, and I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit better.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here. I'm so I'm fully chuffed to talk to you, Dom. I think you described it well. That's a good representation of the sum of who I am, I think.
Okay, because I know that within our little niche fandom community that we've got set up, there are lots of people who love shows like The Genius and Society Game, and we all have a kind of informal or personal interest in game design, the way that these shows are set up and why they're so successful. But you have a professional interest in that too.
That's right. One of the things that's great about doing consulting work and creating games for festivals and for reality TV and so on is that I get to kind of spread the things that influence me. And sometimes they're just delivered straight through with no translation, which is also called stealing. But sometimes they're, they pass through my filter and they jumble together. And I've been so inspired by The Genius and, to an extent, Society Game. But really, The Genius has a place in my heart as the best unscripted show of all time. And getting to, take in, drink in all this great game content. And then in my professional capacity, sort of getting to share aspects of it or make things that I probably would not have made if I hadn't seen these shows. It makes me feel great about amplifying some of this great work that's out there. I mean, do you, this might be as good a place to start as any. The producer, the common denominator between Genius and Society Game, I don't even know that game designer's name. Do you know that game designer's name?
You mean the PD or like the director?
Yes.
I
know Bumbly Umptious, but not really.
But Bumbly Umptious is a deity in their own right, but maybe outside the boundaries of that topic. I know of him, but I don't know who he is. I know of his role as a figure, but I don't remember his name.
Yeah, his name is in the credits of every episode. Oh well, that's quite embarrassing, but nothing for it. Can't be helped. This game creator is one of these categories of people who make me feel like I've accomplished nothing. But it's great because I get to enjoy all this great work.
Yeah, it would be so fascinating to hear or to see some kind of window into that person's mindset, right? They seem like the Robert Moses of game show design.
Or just somebody who seems to so effortlessly, I mean, you never know what somebody's actual work process is like, but when you look at the product that comes out of it, it's just this amazing body of work. And even to get into Society Game, which I don't feel like is especially successful in its first season as a television show, is absolutely noteworthy as a game, the structure overall. And then the challenges within Society Game are successful to varying degrees. But to say, because everybody I know, all my friends and my business partner and my wife, they've heard me bang on about The Genius and on and on and on. And then, there came a point where I was like, well, after four seasons of The Genius, the showrunner was like, I don't want to feel like I'm repeating myself. And then created something that is really creative and original, I feel like. And again, probably not the best outcome. Who knows how different that first season would have been if it hadn't taken place during a heat wave. Genuinely, I do wonder if the elements just kind of degraded the overall level of gameplay. I mean, it certainly broke the only endurance challenge, the treadmill game came to an actual stop, which is not a good thing to happen during a challenge. So who knows, maybe the whole thing would have been Genius season one level if the temperature had been a bit cooler, or maybe not. But I mean, the other person I put in this category is David J. Bodycombe, who's a puzzle writer and game designer and the creator of the Only Connect quiz. This is also someone who I just bow down to the creativity and the game design skills. Looking at his whole CV, there's just a lot there to admire.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Only Connect, and I think for people who maybe aren't British or aren't dialed into the puzzle or game design community, that's going to be a deep cut. I don't know how many people will recognize that name. But yeah, certainly if you're a game show fan and you haven't seen Only Connect, certainly check that out.
Jump on it. Go to the YouTube account called Wheels on Genius. Wheels on Genius is where you can watch the new... It's, I think, the 13th series of Only Connect. It's running now, and it is appointment TV for my wife and myself.
And it is so quintessentially British as well. There's no kind of pretense about it. There's no attempt to jazz it up and make it more exciting than it should be. It just takes it at face value that you're here because you're interested in game shows and obscure knowledge testing game shows. And so that's what we're going to give you. And you're either going to like it and tune in, or you're not going to like it. And that's your call to make.
It's so far from American TV. There, not only are there no bells and whistles, but they reacted to some early criticism that they got that the show was being too esoteric by using Greek letters of the alphabet to identify the different questions. And their response was to make it more esoteric and change from Greek alphabet to Egyptian hieroglyphs.
They really doubled down, yeah. But now, before we move on, I have a bone to pick with you, Miles, because you...
Oh, okay, let's get into it, Dom.
Because you said that... Your wife and other people were sick of hearing you bang on about the genius. I feel like the rest of us did not hear you bang on about the genius nearly early enough, because you were an early adopter of the genius.
Yes.
You were someone who was in from the very beginning. But the rest of us, it took quite some time to discover it. And when you saw all of us out there who you knew were fans of reality shows, of great games, that they wanted good TV, and you thought, well, I don't need to tell them about this. I'll just discover it by themselves at some point. I don't need to nudge them along.
I don't think that's an accurate representation of what I did. I mean, look, I've only got one Twitter account. Well, that's not actually true. But, you know, I only have a couple of Twitter accounts, you know, and I suppose you're saying maybe in hindsight I should have, like, pinned a tweet and just, like, tweeted from morning till night about how great the show was. But I guess maybe I should have done that. I'm not a millennial. I'm a little too old to be a millennial. And so I think I don't love it when people use their social media to, like, I don't know, lean on other people into liking stuff. You know what I always say there's so much out there and nobody's seen it all. So when somebody gives me grief that, oh, what do you mean you've never seen such and such? I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of movies out there. Nobody's seen them all. So. But yes, you're absolutely right. And credit where credit is due, my friend Trip Payne, we're both in the National Puzzlers League, and he posted on Facebook that you got to watch this. And, you know, Trip has also said you got to watch, what is it, Vias des Mole, right? Which is the okay. And for some reason, I never clicked through on that. But when he said you got to watch The Genius, I was like, okay. And just like anyone else, you know, that Garnet heist in season one, you know, got me in. And the 1-2-3 game, you know, overall. So then, yeah, I watched seasons 2, 3, and 4 of The Genius in real time.
Wow. So my first thought when I watched The Genius, I discovered it via a Reddit comment, just some throwaway comment on the Survivor subreddit buried at the bottom of a thread somewhere. And I thought, upon watching it, my first thought was, firstly, how lucky am I that I just stumbled across this and that I now get to share it with other people. But also, I looked at the upload date and thought, wait, this has been up here for years. I could have known about this so long ago. And then from that point, I basically turned into just this evangelist full-time for The Genius, just telling everyone I knew, making sure they would watch it. And I think people were kind of sick of us talking about it by the end, but they watched and they fell in love with it too, and that was the ultimate goal. So mission accomplished on that front, I think.
A few of us. I mean, it is so niche, right? Like, we, for all I know, there are more people who are passionate about the poetry of John Donne than are passionate about The Genius. In fact, that's almost certainly true. And, you know, but the difference is, I don't think a John Donne podcast would have such a lively community surrounding it. And it's so great that your podcast has helped give those of us, those few really of us who care so much about this and who see it you know, for its beauty, and who see it through its imperfections, through the imperfection of episodes being long and subtitled and constantly being taken off the internet, and some games that just don't work, and some contestants that never really distinguish themselves. Through all its imperfections, we see the genius for what it is, and we have each other. So thanks for helping to bring us all together.
Well, thank you. If there are any John Dunn enthusiasts out there, by the way, I'm happy to test that theory. If you want to get in touch, we'll work something out. But yeah, I know that there have been a few people who I haven't directly spoken to about the genius, but who became aware of my fandom of it and gave it a try and said, well, why do you like this show so much? I never really understood it. And that's fine. You know, I'm not expecting everyone to like it. It's not like a necessary criteria of good taste that you fall in love with the genius. But for the people who like that kind of show, it really is the best of the bunch that's out there.
It absolutely is. Yeah. It's so wonderful. And I really like the way that it unfolds as like a four season work, you know, kind of like The Wire is a five season work, and it didn't, you know, and yeah, I just compared The Wire to The Genius, and I would stand by that.
Well, I think the major difference there is that The Wire is bad and overrated, whereas The Genius is criminally underrated, if anything.
Yeah, it's a hot take there, Dom. well, you know,
I've silenced you permanently.
I'm not. You know what? I'm just going to not take the bait. I won't defend The Wire. The Wire is great. Many people think, me among them. But the Genius, you know, there's a very long-reaching conversation. Are games art? Can games be art? And you know, whenever I really need a good night's sleep, I'll wade into that conversation. Puts me right out.
At the risk of putting you to sleep in the middle of a podcast, let's wade into that briefly right now. What's your take on that, and what are the main arguments for and against? What is that debate actually about?
You know, should games? Okay, I belong to some communities like the Indiecade community, which is the International Festival of Independent Games, and it's been compared to Sundance for games. And they just had their 10th year, and it's in downtown Culver City, which is near my home, my former home. I lived in LA for the last 18 years, and just a couple months ago, I moved to Berkeley, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I am very much the essence, the epitome, as Pappy Pascal would say, of that person who lives in LA for almost two decades, moves away, and then can't wait to start shitting all over LA. I don't miss LA at all. I'm very happy here in Berkeley. It suits me. And the reason I bring that up, it's not purely a tangent. It's that I'm not an LA Hollywood phony anymore who only has nice, glad-handing things to say about everybody. Now, when I only have nice things to say about everybody, I'm a sincere, crunchy granola, hippy-dippy Berkeley dad. So it's a totally different category.
Well, quickly, speaking of being one of those granola crunchy dads, I know that your second child is on the way. Your Twitter handle is due date T-minus however many days there are left now. So if this podcast has to end somewhat abruptly, just so people know, that's probably the reason why. But we will hopefully get through this for as long as we have you here.
Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be the podcast equivalent of the sitcom episode with the elevator birth, right?
There would be nothing more worthy of extreme ways than that if you have to leave your child's birth.
Oh, yeah! if you hear a cut to extreme ways, that means that my wife has come and told me, extreme ways. That means my wife is experiencing pressure waves, which is what we in the Berkeley crunchy granola hippy dippy community say instead of contractions or labor pains. We say pressure waves. This podcast could go an hour or a minute, depending on if there's a knock at my study door.
Yeah, so if Miles suddenly disappears, he does have a good excuse. I feel like it's an excuse that only works once, though. Like, if we have to reschedule this for 2 weeks' time, and then you drop out in the middle of that, and you say, oh, well, actually, my wife's having another child, I'm going to be asking some questions.
Be asking some pointed questions. Yeah, you'll be like, I'm sorry, is it a litter? What's going on? Yeah.
well, take it at face value for now, though. So I'm sure we're going to end up talking about the genius at some point, because of course we're going to talk about the genius. And I think the way to do that is to park that for now. Firstly, to build anticipation for that. But then also, if we start talking about it, we're never going to stop. And we probably should talk about Society Game at some point.
You've got a firm, steady hand on the rudder of this podcast, and I feel grateful to be here for it.
Wonderful. So I think the place to start is really talking about neither, but talking about the umbrella that both of them fall under, which is Korean variety shows. So I know that you were a fan of The Genius early on, but also a fan of this genre for quite a long time. So how did you discover it, and what was it about it that really drew you in and kept you interested?
Oh, no, it's actually, I got to fact check you there. It's just The Genius. Haven't seen it. It was the first Korean unscripted show, or the first Korean show that I ever watched. And so just by following the holy word of Bumdi God, I became aware of programs like Crime Scene and, well, I can't really think of any others, but I don't watch any of them because I...
Yeah, I know there are like 5,000 episodes of Running Man or something. I feel obliged to check one of them out at some point just because it's kind of vaguely in the same orbit, but realistically, I'm never going to. It's if it's a choice between just watching The Genius or discovering something new, I'm probably just going to watch The Genius instead.
Yes. I mean, really, until somebody says to you, this is as good as The Genius, or this is a worthy successor to The Genius, just as we were saying, there's so much out there. You got to be really skeptical. You got to hold it at arm's length.
And
either that or develop the skill, which I have not gotten great at quitting a show. I quit Australian Survivor season one. And I hear Australian Survivor season two is worth watching, but I'm going to hold it at arm's length because it's a huge commitment, that many hours. So this will be a short segment because I don't know anything about the other Korean unscripted shows and variety shows. Do you?
No, I don't. I kind of vaguely heard of some of them, but don't really have any actual input to offer. And I think that The Genius, it sets the bar so high and it's spoiled us so thoroughly that now any show that comes along, there's a really high standard to live up to, and very few shows, if any, can live up to it. I think Society Game certainly doesn't. It's still worth watching, I think. It's still fun enough to watch. I don't know if I would have got into it in the first place were it not for the hook provided by The Genius.
That's right. And actually, the Society Game has a much better hook. If I want to tell somebody in 10 words what the show is about, it's much easier for me to pitch them Society Game. The 10-word version of The Genius, there's nothing, like, all I can try to do is, you know, like, make sort of an emotional plea for saying how good it is. But I can't tell you in an elevator pitch why The Genius is such a good format. But the Society Game, I think, has just a really elegant parallelism to it that's a lot of fun.
So for people who maybe haven't watched the Society Game yet, the basic premise is you have two different societies living kind of under the same roof, but in separate areas. And one of them elects a leader democratically every single round. And then the other society is basically led by a dictator who gets appointed at the start through some kind of process. And you're able to rebel. There are some mechanisms for doing that. But the premise is, what happens when you have these two different groups under very different leadership structures? How does that affect how they interact with each other? And how does that affect how they are able to come together as a group in the context of these competitions that they have to go against each other in?
Yes. And for those, I think a great demographic for this podcast would be people who haven't seen Society Game and think that they probably aren't going to. I guess you and I haven't discussed if we want to spoil Society Game. I mean, maybe we should like do that later on, because I think for people who did watch it and liked it or watched some of it, it'll be fun to listen. But I also, somebody's like, I'm not going to watch Society Game, I'd say, okay. And then maybe they'd be able to, you know, enjoy a podcast about it instead of committing to a series watch.
Yeah. So as a brief executive decision now, then, I think the way to handle this is, if we talk about the spoilerous stuff at the end, we sandbox that for its own segment, and just talk in general terms about the premise and the execution and so on at this stage.
That seems like a good executive decision. But unfortunately, I'm going to ring the bell of rebellion so I can wrest executive power from you and decide instead to spoil throughout the episode without warning.
Brilliant. Well, do you have the votes behind you? Is it going to be a failed rebellion? Are you going to get blacklisted?
I think this is going to be a deadlock because there's only the two of us. So I think we got to make fire.
Well, I believe as the existing dictator, I get to break the tie, so...
Oh, yeah, that's good. Okay, we'll go with what you said for now. So yeah, for those who don't know the format of the show, yes, that these two societies exist and they will compete against each other in every episode. And the leader of the losing society picks someone to kick out of the game. So there's an advantage to being the leader because you're not going to kick yourself out. And the leader of the winning society for each game allocates the prize money in any way he or she sees fit. And I was like, oh, that's so good.
Yeah, there's no better driver of drama and just petty resentment than getting to divide up prize money. That's a guaranteed recipe for success on that front.
Yes, like that show, there's an American version of it now where the prize money is distributed unevenly and the players have to like negotiate who gets it while the prize pot is shrinking. You know that game show?
No, I haven't heard of it.
It's called Split or Uneven or something. It's diabolical. And in fact, it's actually kind of unfun to watch because they answer trivia questions, the prize pot grows, and then the prize pot is randomly split into three chunks, large, medium, and small. And they start a countdown clock. And they have to agree which of the three contestants gets which prize pot. And if it's not unanimous, they all get zero. And while they're arguing, each prize pot is shrinking. So just as you said, I mean, really, I think that, yeah, it's the essence of, or, you know, it can be a great engine to a reality competition. How is the money allocated? And giving this executive branch the right to decide and the right to kick people out just makes the, you know, it's supposed to stoke the fire within each player. How can I be the leader? How often can I be the leader? How soon can I be the leader? How shall I depose the leader?
And that's actually one of the more curious changes for season two, I believe, when now the prize money distribution is not announced publicly until the very end, I think.
Oh, so I actually don't know anything about season two because just as we were saying about being conservative, I'm going to wait until a community of internet people dressed up in a Bundy suit finishes, or, you know, makes a commitment to finishing subtitling the show. What do I want to watch three episodes for with no certainty that it's going to be seen to completion? I mean, if I wanted to enjoy a show that I had no certainty was going to be carried out, I could watch Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Well, that effort seems to have stalled for the time being, which is unfortunate. And I don't want to watch it and get attached to it because then I'm going to be just waiting until the day I die for these future subtitles. And then if I don't get attached to it, I've wasted hours and hours and literally hours of my life. Like it's the society game is not known for brevity, to put it mildly.
Oh, there's so much air in every episode. I mean, there really is.
I know. So that there was discussion recently about whether the Survivor premiere could really accomplish what it set out to do within the course of an hour. And it really needed, I think the consensus was, it needed at least an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours to fully breathe. Society Game is the exact opposite. You could happily cut that episode in half and nothing of value would have been lost.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a 90-minute premiere for Survivor, I can't imagine anybody taking a position that that's not the best length for a premiere. I think whenever I think of a 2-hour Survivor premiere, I just think of Heroes versus Villains, you know, which is still probably like the best season of all time. But there was time in that 2-hour premiere for Colby to talk about the color of his hat and the color of Jerry's hat. And I'm hearing this hat Matt chat and thinking like, all right, let's, we can cut here. 90 minutes is good. Not to impugn Heroes versus Villains. But yeah, Society Game, I mean, aside from the premiere, which is handily the best episode and features one of the best games, or I should say one of the best game elements, being the physical competition that's nested within the Jangi game, that could have been 90 minutes. That would have been good. And then every other episode, yeah, like 42, like American network length would be great.
Yeah, I feel like if you're able to make it through an episode of the Society Game, that's a true sign of commitment to the genre. Like you know that this is for you. Because I feel like with The Genius, if you're someone who maybe is not naturally drawn to that type of show, you can still be hooked in by just how incredible it is at what it's trying to do. Whereas Society Game, unless you're coming in with that commitment already, it's not going to develop that. You're going to watch one episode, get bored halfway through, never finish it, and never revisit it ever again.
I felt like it was even worse, actually, because I thought that the Society Game's first episode was interesting enough in a number of ways that it kept me wanting to watch. And it didn't actually start to get bad until about, I want to say like 4 episodes in. And now my season 1 watch was happening, you know, in real time. And I don't know how long ago that was. I guess it was last year. But so I don't have everything very fresh in mind. And I don't know the creator of the game. Do you have any screening process for guests? I don't know how I was allowed.
Absolutely none. No, it's basically, yeah. If you want to come on, just let me know and you know, you'll get a platform.
All right. Well, lucky me. I've worked the system. Really, it was, it was sort of a sunk cost at that point that I wanted to see the show through. And thank God for MJ. Who,
yes.
Really,
well,
it's
spoiler alert, but yeah.
No. What I'm saying is that, yeah, okay, yeah, here's the spoiler. There's a contestant named MJ who is not eliminated early, okay? And her presence in the show is absolutely the keystone, the bright, shining star. She is, I would compare her to Kathy Vavrick O'Brien in season 4 if she didn't have a meltdown at the beginning. Like, she is such a rootable character, she delivers. MJ is great. She's a breakout star, and I know that she's invited back to be on season 2, where she is competing against Dong Min from The Genius. So that's estimable. Did you hear that, Dom? The Dong Min and MJ.
I did. I watched the premiere of season 2 where they.
They
already make for a somewhat interesting pairing, so not going to reveal anything more about that. But yeah, we will save our MJ fandom hour for the end, for the time being.
Really? Can we talk about what she does in the physical game in the first episode?
Okay, I didn't remember it, so you'll have to talk about it, but sure, go ahead.
Okay, let me paint you a picture. Actually, you know, you should, boy... I used to have this, like, video... It's so hard to queue up the clip, but I have done it. I have showed people this moment because what MJ does in the rope game is like the Garnet heist in season 1 of The Genius. And that's adjusted for inflation. The Garnet heist is better because The Genius is better. But what MJ does in this competition is the jaw-dropping moment that I shared with everybody and actually works better as a standalone moment because the Garnet heist doesn't make as much sense unless you just watch the whole episode.
And just to jump in quickly, I think that's one of the crucial differences between The Genius and Society Game. Whereas on The Genius, you know that the whole episode is building towards this this climax at the end. So even when there's this lull or this slow period in the middle, you can excuse that because you know that it's going to pick back up again and you know that it's in the service of something larger. And then also, The Genius has this central hook that it's developed over time of you can never really be sure of anything that you're seeing, and there's always, yes, going to be some twist, something behind the curtain that's going to spring out at the last moment. And so when you see something that seems like it's obvious or slow or you don't really know what the joke is, you know that there is a joke, you're just not in on it yet, and you want to keep watching so you can discover what that is. With the Society Game, they really don't go to that kind of level. It's just what you see is what you get, and so if what you're seeing is not that interesting, then that's also what you're getting.
Yeah. And, you know, again, you know, coming from this creative director, you know, I think if he'd done the 1 hour earlier gag in Society Game, like he had done his Genius, I think the fans would have been very pleased and it probably would have benefited the show. But I can't fault him for wanting to say, no, I'm not going to be, you know, a one trick pony. I've got other things to do. So, you know, there's secret voting in Society Game, which is not in The Genius. So if he's like, well, part of the story has to be concealed, and that's already happening because of the blacklist and because of the votes. And, you know, that's true, but it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't reach that ethereal level. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have its moments, like MJ and the rope.
Yes, more MJ in the rope right now, I suppose. So get into what you felt was so fascinating about that.
So they played, do you remember the Jenga game from the first episode?
Yeah.
So they move pieces on the board, the two societies, the Society of the North and the Society of the South. And the pieces all have a number on the underneath of them. So when the two pieces are placed next to each other, they are flipped over and if the North puts a piece next to the South or vice versa, they're flipped up and we see the two numbers underneath, and the numbers have been assigned to the players, and those two players are going to compete against each other. But what's more, the sum of the numbers determines whether they'll be playing a game in the categories physical, mental, or dexterity. And those three categories of game are represented consistently in the challenges throughout, and they are called out as such. And players are basically affiliated with those skills, but sometimes have to work within different categories. So it's much like what you see in Survivor. You need someone to be your puzzle maker and someone to be your swimmer. But I think actually that aspect of it is one of the parts of society game that works. What doesn't work is that the dexterity people throw rings at a ring toss. And the ring toss is like 2 feet off the ground. And people throwing rings at a ring toss 2 feet off the ground is very boring. Sometimes it's a little exciting if they're close. But I was like, dear God, make it taller. Make it a hat rack so at least they're throwing up. Like, it looks like even too low grade to be a backyard game. And I know that that's a nitpick, but I just, like, I'm just so sure in my bones that that ring toss shouldn't have been so low to the ground.
But see, that's the kind of thing which I think only people like you who have this keen eye for that kind of thing notice or really care about, right? Like the rest of us, we just watch that and think, oh, that's a ring toss. That's unremarkable. But for you, that's like a seething like moment of professional like anger, right?
I didn't even think about it, but I can picture, like, I know people who walk into a room and are like, oh, those colors don't go together, right? And I would be like, oh, they both look kind of tan white to me. So I guess this is me on the other side of a dynamic like that. It's
yeah.
Kind of fun.
Like, because when I always say that, oh, I don't really care about the challenges in Survivor, I know that that's excusing or just ignoring so much good work that's done by John Kirchhoffer and people like you to make all that come together. But I think it's because I just don't really have the vision to see what that could or should look like. So if it's a challenge which I've kind of seen before, it doesn't really stand out, I don't stop to think, oh, well, this is how it could be different, or this is what I'm imagining instead. It just kind of all goes over my head.
But let me ask you this. Up to now, are you caught up on Heroes, Healers, and Hustlers?
I am, yeah.
Okay, so the signpost that spun around and fit through the little gate,
yes,
and the intersecting pieces with the colors that matched, that you recognize that was new and that was good, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so those were both, and I emailed, it's autumn, it's fall, so the names are dropping. I emailed John Kirchhoffer and was like, are those Arbuckle puzzles? There was this new consultant in the room who I believe was also a Dream Teamer, Arbuckle. He had a vulgar nickname that I'm not going to say, and I don't remember his first name. I really only remember his last name because of his vulgar nickname. But and John was like, yeah, those are Arbuckle puzzles. And my thought to myself was, oh, that kid is good. I need to kind of step up, because this fresh young millennial's got such sharp ideas.
Well, if he carries on at this pace, he'll be known for something other than a vulgar nickname, which really never do, would it?
Not if I have anything to do with it.
So you notice that kind of stuff. What was it about, to resume the society game discussion, what was it about this whole challenge that was like the big moment for you then?
Okay, they could match their numbers to each other and play a ring toss. So it's like if the numbers combined made a low number, they would compete physically. If they made a high number, they would compete mentally. And if they made a middle-ish number, they would compete in a dexterity game, which was a ring toss. The mental game was, I thought it was great, but it was not really good TV. It was a puzzle, and the puzzles were of different kinds. And they were not a manipulable puzzle. They have a very, very large screen in the arena where they're playing the game. And actually, the build of the arena, I think, is really interesting also in the way it plays into the game. We can perhaps return to that later. That it's shaped somewhat like a peace sign from overhead. Anyhow, so they just look at the screen and they solve a puzzle. It was kind of like, if you ever listen to Will Shortz on National Public Radio on Sundays, he'll do a quiz and kind of ask a wordplay kind of question. They were like that. And then the physical game was what was really, really great. Okay, so you remember the challenge Kicking and Screaming that's been on Survivor, where, why would you know the name? One player hugs a pole and the opposing tribe has to pull that person off the pole and drag them across the finish line.
Oh, that challenge is great. And just so my entirely unqualified opinion on this, and feel free to slap me down if you think it is off base. But to me, that seems like the kind of challenge which could and maybe should be incorporated as much as possible, because it seems very cheap to set up, my impression is.
Yes.
Visually, it's very engaging. Like, you're drawn in, you can tell what's happening. There's no complicated, like, oh, this person's untangling ropes, and here's a bag of puzzle pieces that's going through a chain or something. It's very graphic, very easy to understand. And also, it's just good drama. Like, it's great TV.
I love that challenge, and that I believe that was design was really Dan Mundy gets a lot of the credit for creating that great challenge, who worked side by side with Kerhofer for years and years in the art department. So, but there's a reason why you haven't seen Kicking and Screaming very much lately, and that is, of course, that you can't play it with three tribes, or you can, but it's hard to make it fair. And you can come up with ideas, but they aren't as straightforward as when it's played with two tribes. And most episodes now have three tribes. So that's why you don't see Kicking and Screaming as much anymore.
So that's another promising tangent quickly then. So what are there aspects of challenge design and the game design in general that we're maybe not privy to, but which the other choices made by production feed into? So when it is two tribes versus three tribes, does that kill a lot of challenges which we might otherwise have seen, or is that like a hidden downside that we may be not even aware of?
It absolutely does. Kicking and Screaming, like Sumo at Sea or Schmergen Brawl, all of these challenges can be broadly categorized as combat challenges because the players engage in, physical grappling with each other. There has never been a combat challenge in a Three Tribe episode because so far there hasn't been one that has been deemed fair enough and easy to shoot. That's the more Three Tribe episodes there are, the fewer combat challenges there will be. And also, there's generally a reluctance to play combat challenges for immunity. Although it has happened, historically, combat challenges are almost always deployed for reward because you really don't want people to pull out all the stops. I mean, you see how they go after each other if they're playing for peanut butter and jelly. If it's like one of you will be eliminated from the competition for the $1 million prize, do they break someone's arm? Better not to find out. That's another reason why there haven't been a ton of combat challenges in the last 10 or so seasons.
Now that's the kind of thing which, when you say it, it sounds so obvious and so clearly true. But I never would have arrived at that myself or even thought about it unless you brought it up.
Well, I don't have any. I really don't have anything intelligent to say about challenges that isn't just me parroting John Kerhofer, and because I don't live in LA anymore, and I'm not a Hollywood phony, and I'm an on the level Berkeley hippy dippy crunchy granola, having gotten to work side by side in pre-production only. Like, I've never worked on location where John is, really in his element. But just getting to share a dry erase board with the man is a professional privilege that it makes me so lucky and grateful and happy to, be where I am in life, even if I'll never be David J. Bodycombe. But the other thing is that he is just like such a good man and role model and kind, inspirational friend that I really only have loads and loads of heartfelt good things to say about my friend John. And he also has all this wisdom about being the one and only challenge producer on Survivor. Of course, there have been, game producers for years. There are people who have a job description somewhat like John's who worked on The Price is Right, for decades. And John was one of those guys, right? He worked on Shop Till You Drop, and he created game show gags and doodads before he was the challenge producer on this show called Survivor that, nobody thought was going to succeed and that every network turned down at least once. And so now flash forward, and no one's ever done a job like he has for as long as he has. He's the first and the only. So he knows a lot. And I sometimes, I tend to listen a lot. And it's easy because he tells the same stories over and over again. But I love him. I love him. And so that's how I pick up on, this professional expertise and wisdom that comes with being the first and only.
And now you get to deliver that wisdom secondhand through platforms like this, I guess.
I come off so good.
You really do. Yeah. Now I don't, because as a host, I can't remember what we were talking about before. So where were we, Miles?
MJ and the rope. Yes. If they chose dexterity, they threw ring toss. If they chose mental, they answered puzzles. And if they chose physical, they played this game that is similar to kicking and screaming, but different. Both of them are elemental games, schoolyard games, games that you go, wait, haven't people like been playing that for hundreds of years? Like, did cavemen play that game? And they didn't, but they're new games that seem like they were. Here's how you play the game, which is named in the tradition of genius games. I don't think it's called rope game, but it's not far off. So I'm going to attempt to paint a picture with words because this is an audio medium, and I should be able to do this because I do pitch challenges. This just, of course, is not my own. Okay, so there's two competitors, and each of you has a leash, a tether, a harness, like a belt that fits around your midsection, and it is connected to a long, slack piece of rope, and then about 10 feet behind you, there's a tree stump, and on that tree stump, there's like a little log, like a fireplace log, and it's standing up on its side, and it's tied to the other end of your leash. So basically, if you move too much, your log is going to fall off of your stump and hit the ground. The first player whose log hits the ground loses and scores a point for the other team. And that's it. That's the whole game. So when the ref says go, you know, a good strategy is to like grab your opponent and throw him to the ground or throw her to the ground. And that's what most of them do. They grapple back and forth in a style that's kind of like Greco-Roman wrestling. And the other interesting thing about this game is that the leash has slack, but it actually doesn't have all that much slack. And so in this game, friendly fire is a risk. If you and I are grappling and I've got you, you know, on the ropes, so to speak, but our feet, as we're scuffling in the dirt, we're moving closer to your stump. Well, we're moving farther than my stump and my log will fall off. And I was like, that happened to some of the contestants. They were like, oh. And MJ had been assigned a number. The number that was written under her block was one that meant that she wasn't going to end up in very many of the combat games because she was like a low high number. So she got to watch this game played. Oh, and they get to practice this game in their home society. And MJ is coaching everybody. And this is still episode one. And it's clear, like, this woman, and she's a mixed martial artist athlete. And she is coaching people on how to play the game. And she tells them, actually, even before they're playing against the other society, she says, it's a balance game. And but then, you know, all the numbers are getting turned up and it's two men and the men wrestle with each other and they win or they lose. And then MJ's number comes up. And so she goes to wrestle against a man. And they play not extreme ways, but something like it. And so the ref says go. And here is where, when you're watching this episode, the conventions of Korean television are kind of obnoxious, because picture this, right? I'm on Dailymotion and I've found this episode, which is not like Dailymotion's search feature is not good. So I had to find Bum Diddley's account and click on it and then scroll down and find the right episode, wait for it to load, wait for the ads to play, then scrub forward in the episode because I want to show this one moment to my friends while more ads play. And although on an American reality show, before they go to commercial, like one of the Project Runway, like, when we come back, hey, where are my scissors? And then they come back and like in the first act we hear, hey, where are my scissors? Like, if you watch the show, you're going to see the same bits play again and again. Well, that's true like times seven on a lot of these shows.
Yes.
Like, you know, Jin-ho says flip the card, and we see him flip the card, and we see him flip it again, and we see it from the drone, and we see it from the left, and we see it from the right. It's like, okay. If that's not the kind of TV you're used to watching, it's kind of obnoxious. But here's MJ and the man from the other society, and the ref hasn't said go, but they are in each other's faces. They're like breathing on each other, and they've got their arms ready to grab each other's shoulders. And the ref says go, and they hold each other, and they wrestle, and they Greco-Roman wrestle. And MJ totally holds her own. She's got this guy. He's got her. Without losing her footing, she picks up one ankle, wraps it around his body, wraps the rope around her foot and gives it a tug, and the stump hits the ground before the dude even knows what's going on. It is so cool. It's so cool that if you find it, if you go through that process I just described and watch it, it is so cool, even if you know what's going to happen. The room goes crazy when I show it to people. I showed it in the Survivor Challenge room. So that moment was like, okay, this is worth watching. And then, you know, MJ is not eliminated early. And over the course of a few episodes, we get to see what else she can do, not just in the physical arena. Sometimes she plays in mental or dexterity. So MJ is great, and I love her.
You've described it well enough. I need to go back and watch this now. This sounds like something that I really should have been paying attention to at the time that I was really missing out on.
It's sick. Like, you know, Vine isn't around anymore, but this would be a sick Vine.
Rip Vine. Gone before its time, for sure. Now, let's...
I thought you were saying Rip Vine because by saying sick Vine, I revealed that, like, I'm old and out of touch and the kids aren't saying sick anymore. They're saying rip. And I was like, I guess it's like on fleek. I guess I just got to retire that.
Miles, I'm not in touch with the kids either. Not remotely. So it's possible that all of these linguistic conventions have long since passed me by, but I'm just...
You're so out of touch with the youth that you voted for Brexit.
Oh, okay, well, let's not get into that again. So anyway, let's go back to the wider format of Society Game, because the first thing that I thought when I saw this was, it's an interesting premise, but I don't know how it's actually going to work out in practice, because as a refresher, so the Mardong, so the dictator tribe, they choose a dictator, or a dictator is chosen for them at the start of the first round, and then that person...
You remember how they chose the dictator?
I remember how they did it in season 2, which was kind of weird. They stuck their hand into a snake pit. How do they do it in season 1?
It's very similar. It was also a Fear Factor gag. In season 1, they brought out a container of roaches, blended them into a smoothie, filled several glasses, and the first person to down the smoothie was the leader of the Madong Society.
Oh, of course. It's the gross food challenge, essentially.
It was, and it was revolting.
Yeah, absolutely. I see what you're doing there. Well done. It took me a while to catch on, but...
That was unintentional, but I'm going to take credit for it anyway.
Perfect. So the way it works is, when you become the dictator of Mardong, you get to hand out these keys of rebellion to two people, and those people are the only ones who can launch any kind of coup attempt against you as the dictator. So they can go into the room where the gong is held, ring the gong, and then if enough people sign on, if a majority sign on, then you are overthrown. They become the new dictator. And I was thinking, well, the way the game's set up, it's structured so that when you get down to the end, all that really matters is being able to win that final challenge. So you want to have the strongest team possible in physical competitions, in mental, in dexterity. And if you're able to identify people with those skill sets early, like let's say I'm the strongest dexterity competitor, if I can find the best physical person and the best mental person and give them the keys, well, they really have no interest in rebelling. They can't conceivably gain anything. And as long as there's no like interpersonal thing that messes that up, there's really nothing to stop us just running that the whole way through. And it turns out, not to get into too much detail, that isn't what ends up happening. But it feels like if you had this entirely like cutthroat, self-interested group of people who were just looking at it from that angle, then there's no reason why that couldn't and shouldn't happen most of the time.
Yes, you're right that optimal play would be predictable. And I think that's true on Survivor as well, right? You should just form your final three and eliminate everybody else. But, you know, when it's people playing, that's, you know, easier said than done. It doesn't always turn out that way. But I think that, yeah, the way you've apprehended that, I didn't think of it that way, but I think that makes a lot of sense. See, I think you have one of the great things about listening to your podcast is I think you have this great strategic mind. And, you know, I think that like, if you entered the arena, you know, with that approach and you shared it with the right people, I bet you'd get cast and I bet you'd go far.
I strongly doubt that. So we're trying to set up a contest against Robin Steven for the Know-It-Alls in New York in a few weeks. And if we do end up playing like Indian poker or anything else, I'm just going to get humiliated in front of a large audience. And it's going to be, I'll be coming home with my tail between my legs. So
you can't play like that, though. When you're playing against Robin Steven, you can't let the bright lights intimidate you. You know, you can beat those guys. All you have to do, you just do what you do and relax. You know, you'll be just fine. So it's going to be the four of you, I guess, to make the most obvious joke suggestion that you should play Tactical Yutnori.
Yes. Oh, that's what I suggested. We need to have like a a Rocky-esque training montage of us just like practicing tactical Yutnori over and over again frantically in the next 2 weeks. But yeah, because I think that feeds into a larger question about game design, which is, even if it has this theoretical flaw, if you have reason to think that people either won't notice that flaw or won't exploit that flaw, or that there are other reasons why it won't matter, does that actually weigh on whether it's a good decision or not?
Well, I mean, so here's what I think a game is. And I'm not the first person to say this, but a game is a series of interesting choices. So what you describe is a very good choice, but it's not the choice that everybody is necessarily going to make. I mean, but that's just, I'm not being too specific to this one particular tactic about a society game. If you create a game that it's possible for somebody to hack, does that make it a flawed game? I mean, is that the question at hand? So that I just got so such a windbag.
Yeah, kind of. So we see this a lot in the context of The Genius as well, where when we were discussing some of the games, we thought, well, if everyone just didn't have the same kind of cultural reservations about playing in such an aggressive manner that a lot of contestants seem to, then there would be ways to hack this game, or to, even if the game wouldn't be fundamentally broken, it just wouldn't be as interesting. But given that people do seem to play with this code of honor almost, within mm-hmm. within those parameters, the game becomes that much more interesting. So when you have a game like that, does the fact that there is this hypothetical issue that could exist, does that weigh on whether it's a good game in the abstract, or a good choice as a producer to include it? Or if you have reason to suspect that won't come into play, can you just go ahead and not have to think about it?
I don't think you can. You can't anticipate, especially when you're the designer, you're going to envision the way a game is played in a particular way, and the players are going to come at it from their perspective, and you can't always predict what they're going to do. I mean, in the context of The Genius, what I want to say, the player, he made it to the finals without going to any Garnets. Yeah, he hacked the whole enchilada, and they had to edit the rules for the following season because of him. And I don't think, so game design, I mean, like, it can be really disappointing. Like, in the first episode of Survivor Nicaragua, which was the first intentionally old versus young season, we all know how that turned out. The opening immunity challenge, or actually, I can't remember if it's the opening or not, but they had an immunity. They didn't want to do anything that was particularly strength based because they had done old versus young. And they did something involving holding troughs of different lengths and passing water from the top of a structure to the bottom people standing different levels and holding these troughs. Yeah. So when they play tested it, people were like holding the troughs in like funny angles, and it was visually dynamic. And then when the tribes played it, they just passed it in a straight line like it was a rain gutter, because it was actually the most efficient way to make it happen. And it was not at all interesting. Like, they should have, like, it was as though they'd just given them a piece of PVC piping. So all of that is simply to say you can't always predict how people are going to play your game. And sometimes it turns out great, like I think Kyungran, and sometimes it turns out problematic.
It felt like with that example, they really did drop the ball a bit, because how isn't that the most obvious way of setting up that challenge? It's not some amazingly creative hack that no one could have thought of. It's just I put the pipes in order and the water flows through them.
Well, you know, it's easy to say that in hindsight. At the time that they were designing it, there was nobody who was better qualified to make that. And I think the version of the game they were trying to make, I've actually seen it. They did it on South African Survivor. And there were enough better changes that we all watched it in the challenge room. We're like, yeah, that's what it was supposed to be, but they probably wouldn't have made it unless they'd seen the broken version in Nicaragua, or maybe they would. No, they wouldn't have.
So I think that's the fundamental kind of tension in that job as a game designer, of you don't want to figure out everything about your game, right? You want there to be angles that you haven't explored, that you can be blindsided yourself by the participants finding something that you hadn't thought of. But you also don't want that to be something which makes the game less interesting or less good from a TV standpoint, or which like ends it too soon or anything like that. So you always have to hope that there is some hack, but that hack isn't so broken that it just disrupts the entire premise.
You want it to be aligned with your goals. If your goal is to make the show more interesting, and if the person who comes up with the hack, I mean, like Sang-min was the person who figured out a way to dance as a secret code to help his team win, what was the elevator game. Like, hey, listen, if you're going to make up strategies that involve you dancing, that's great. Do that, you know, but you just need to make sure that the, that they're aligned with your, with your, with your goal. And, you know, so like survivor advantages that would take the people who are already on the bottom and make their position worse, you know, twists like that aren't good. You know, the disadvantage, the already disadvantaged, a good twist, you know, you really want it to upend the status quo. So, I mean, but to this, to the question of like, well, could the society that had rebellion as its structure have been just a crummy idea from the get-go? You know, I know that's not what you're saying, but just as like a thought exercise, I think that given that, you know, there were other incentives and you want to get the most money in the, in your own prize pot before the game is over. And, you know, you're not necessarily going to agree on who's the best mental, physical and dexterity player. And I think a big part of the drama in the last four or five episodes of Society Game was about two players who both believed that they were the best mental player, or they were the player who both best deserved to go on in the series, and trying to make their case to the leader of the society who, you know, kind of got to do what he wanted. And yeah, the aspect of like, let me keep the keys of rebellion out of the hands of the people who would benefit by my being overturned. You know, there's a big risk that things would be kind of pat, and they kind of were. There were not a ton of rebellions, and most of the rebellions that happened, a lot of them were done with consent.
Yeah, that, and so that was one of the really shocking things for me, of seeing how, yeah. And maybe this is a cultural norm that I wasn't really attuned to going in, but the way that people almost seemed like, when they screwed up, there was almost a sense of, well, I should be overthrown. I ought to, you know, step down, or there ought to be a changing of the guard. And I think if you saw that on Survivor, it would stand out so much, and that person would just get torn apart on social media and so on for not having that kind of cutthroat mentality.
The cutthroat mentality was lacking throughout most of Society Game, because I think what you said is like, well, you know, the status quo will be uninteresting. What's going to shake up the status quo is intrigue, right? Take the players who have a key and who believe that there's no incentive for them to rebel, and then start whispering in that person's ear. Create circumstances where they do think that rebelling advantages them. And there wasn't a lot of that. I mean, the mateship that we saw on display in Australia, you know, a lot of that was present in Society Game. People, you know, it was the chalk pick went home a lot of the time. And the rebellions just weren't as dynamic. I mean, I think the game would, it could be great with American game show contestants. I just think those people would be like, what do you mean there's a gong in there? I'll bang it, I'll bang anything. You know, like, I think that there'd be more likelihood to mix it up. I think that there was a lot of courtesy on display, and aside from Jeopardy and Only Connect, you know, courtesy is not the hallmark of a lot of great competition shows.
So with that in mind, how possible is it to evaluate the merits of a given format for the game without knowing about the kind of cultural context of the participants who are going to be playing it?
Well, I mean, it's like evaluating anything else, right? It's going to be like your taste, like Society Game, you know, and I think I feel like you and I are kind of on the same page. You're like, Society Game doesn't stink. And the idea behind it is really worth it, really worth seeing the experiment, how it plays out. And it would have been better if the experiment was a more lively TV show, because for the most part, it's not that. But it's still like a game that I think, you know, I'm glad it's getting played again. I think I put a pin in the arena, the environment in which they play, which I think is actually a really important part of the game design. And I really like that about it, you know, but maybe it's just, I like shows like Crystal Maze and Fort Boyard, where where they've got these artificial game, you know, habitats that are like part of the rules, really. Like your home is part of the rules. And it really is their home, unlike those other shows I mentioned, which maybe we should find a way to reboot. I actually had this thought in my mind. I was like, ooh, what if, you know, in the same way that like America's Next Top Model turned this page, you know, many cycles in, they call their season cycles, and they put boys in the house. And there was always this before and after. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about Redemption Island and Survivor. Like, even if we never see it again, there was a before Redemption Island and an after. And I was like, what if Survivor, like, did a season that was like Survivor, Fortress Escape, and like their habitat wasn't an island, but it was like the Fort Boyard set. And I don't know what else you would do with that, but that would certainly be...
I don't care what else you did. I would tune in anyway. That sounds like a fantastic premise for a show. And that was going to be one of my next questions, actually, was how the setting for a game or its physical environment affects both the way that participants understand it and behave in that environment, and then also the way that viewers understand and enjoy the show, knowing that that's the context for it. So Survivor, I think, is very unique in that you have this vast open space which is seemingly unbounded, which and in practice you know that if you wander too close to a production compound or something, then you're going to get turned away. But it feels very much like you are just kind of out there in a natural environment. There's no artifice around, there's no there are no buildings, basically, right? Whereas the Genius, Society Game, Big Brother, whatever it is, it's in a very self-contained environment, and that has implications both for things like, you know, like idols on Survivor. You go on this massive treasure hunt. You go across the whole island, and you know that you're going to miss something. You know you can't possibly cover anything. When, you know, Sangmin is looking for the Token of Immortality in the Genius, well, he can case the entire building in an hour, right? So that changes that changes some of the twists that you're able to put in there. But just in general, what are the larger points that are worth making about that, do you think?
Well, about in Society Game in particular, I think is a really good illustration of that, because you picture this compound that they built for the show, kind of like a peace sign, but just split into three equal wedges. And there's the Society of the North, the Society of the South, and the third segment is where they go to compete. So they exit their homes and they go into this middle area and they see what game has been set up for them. And so you get that fun reveal, same as when the survivors walk up to Challenge Beach. Within each society, there's a room that only the leader gets to sleep in, and it's got air conditioning and a fridge. And what I love is that when anybody other than the leader enters the leader's room, it's like, hey, come on in, let's have a conversation, let's conspire, it's my room, I can invite in whomever I please, production switches off the air conditioning. So it's only for the leader. And that's such a nice twist. It's got a lot going for it. They also, over the course of the whole season, they hide a clue in each society, or they hide like an advantage. And that is a real dud, because the clues, like the players don't really add them up very well. And then when they find it, I don't think neither of them uses it to any, one of them, I don't think it's used at all. And the other one is used to really no effect. So that, I think, I can't imagine that idea, the way it panned out, like the specifics of it, I don't think was ever a good idea to begin with. So it's kind of like, maybe that was kind of like in American TV, we get network notes. Maybe the network was like, you got to hide a clue. And so, he was like, all right, but didn't have his heart in it. Or maybe he thought it was great. He's like, this is my greatest invention. This is greater than this is greater than Open Pass. And he was wrong. It just wasn't actually very good.
Yeah, the big reveal there, it wasn't even big or much of a reveal. It was just kind of underwhelming, ultimately.
It was quite underwhelming. And it didn't even, like, we didn't get good TV out of it. It totally fell flat. And you're like, wow, we're still spending time on this, huh? In a 42-minute episode, it definitely would have been cut out. It'd be like the idol that Parvati found on Exile in here at Fans versus Favorites that she didn't even bring back home with her. And so it didn't even make it into the show. But I think the environment in which you play, I think it does matter a great deal. And I was about to say that I think in a way, the amount of play area that they have on Survivor is perhaps less than we might think it is. Like, I believe, just as you're saying, there are out of bounds areas But I believe that playing Survivor is perhaps somewhat more like playing the Genius than you might think, because there are actually only so many places that you can go. But then, just as I was thinking that, you brought up the example of hunting all over the island for an idol. And I think that you made me realize that that is actually what I was thinking is not correct at all. And I think that that is, that's great. I know for myself, I mean, I am, I don't work in television. I don't think it's safe to say that I work in television. I own a small business and I occasionally get consulting jobs working in television. But I've been fired off of just about every show I've worked on except Survivor. And draw from that what you will. So I'm not in television, but I would love to, sell the American version of The Genius. And, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we should get our hopes up, because I think that if you took a name from the phone book, that person is about as likely to sell the American version of The Genius as I am. I just think it's a long shot.
Yeah, just to jump in briefly, about 2 years ago, a British production company brought the rights to The Genius here in the UK. And they were making this video of...
I watched it.
Yeah, of fans talking about it. And I did a brief segment for that, and I was thinking, like, how am I meant to pitch this to people? I can say, oh, the show is great, it's really exciting, and so on, but I can't really explain what it is about the show, about what it is as a show, about the format that leads to that. It's just, oh, this show is great. But that, if you're an executive looking to greenlight a new show, of course, fans of a show are going to say it's great, but that doesn't tell you anything, right? You need to know why. You need to know how you can replicate that within the slightly different context that you're going to be producing the show in a different country. And I think for The Genius, that's a really hard sell.
I have been in the room and tried to sell it, and I'm here to tell you it is. Yeah. It's a hard sell. I mean, it shouldn't have to be. I mean, almost it's like, oh, if you have to make a sizzle reel of why your show is good, haven't you already lost? Because it shouldn't be incumbent on you or anybody else in that video to have to like articulate what about it is great. You know, it should be enough to say, this show really makes me feel something. It makes me feel thrilled and excited, and it makes me feel like I can't wait for the next one. And if that show were like a, you know, like Cupcake Tree Battles, where two teams of your favorite reality stars are going to hit a cupcake tree with wiffle bats until one of them throws up, like, that's the kind of show that gets made. I'm sorry to be a snob. But, just the fact that The Genius is well made and people are passionate about it isn't enough, because you have to sell it to some network executive who is self-interested and wants to preserve their job and isn't going to stick their neck out on a complicated competition series. Even though if they did, if you can imagine this show, like, what about Downton Abbey? Did somebody know it was going to be a runaway smash? They didn't know. That's why it was on PBS. And it was a runaway smash. And it's like, well, you know, it's stuffy English people and it's upstairs, downstairs. Well, people had an affection for it and it made them feel something. And that should be enough.
And as a stuffy English person, I can testify that there's this like weird fascination with British culture. The way that some people like really fetishize Japanese culture and so on, that there's a certain subset of the population that just is completely obsessed with anything British, and it's kind of weird to be on the receiving end of sometimes, or to have that perspective on it. But for as much as it shouldn't work, right? There's no reason why Downton Abbey should be a hit in the US. It wasn't entirely surprising to me that it was. Like, it's something that I've seen before in a few different contexts.
Sure, yeah. But, yeah, of course. Well, there's this, I mean, I think I've, you know, I may be on the record saying this, you know, elsewhere, but there's this, you know, prejudice, I think, against shows being too brainy. The viewers are brainy enough for the shows. Really, it's the people who, the gatekeepers, you know, around here, you know, the gatekeepers, you know, they have the job they have because they went to Stanford with somebody and they were somebody's fraternity brother, not because they can identify what show is going to be the next Downton Abbey or, you know, anything else. When people hear about a show like The Genius, a common refrain is a knee jerk reaction is like, that makes my brain hurt. That's too smart. I don't like that. But do people turn off the Olympics because those people are too athletic? Like, that makes me feel out of shape. I mean, some people do, but lots of people don't. So there's just this difference in the way a challenging mental obstacle is viewed when compared to a challenging physical obstacle.
Yeah, I wonder if the issue with that analogy is that when you watch the Olympics or when you watch any great sporting event, you don't know what it is that they're doing better than you. You know that they are better than you, but you can at least visually understand what's going on, right? Whereas if you feel just mentally outclassed, a lot of the details of that are just going completely over your head. So if
it's... Sometimes, but one of the things that makes the genius so great is the animatics and the narration that tells you why what you're watching is so good.
And I would agree, but I think people have a much better frame of reference for, oh, I watch football or whatever, and even though I obviously can't compete at that level, I can appreciate that they are and why they are, and I can enjoy watching it. I think most people just naturally encounter many fewer examples of that in a mental game.
Yeah, and that's where it gets get back to the fact that ours is a small niche community, like John Donne poetry fans, right? Like, I feel in my bones, I feel like if I could wave a magic wand and put the polished version of The American Genius that I see in my mind and put it on HBO, which I feel like is where it belongs, PBS is also a strong second place, I think it would resonate with viewers and it would find its audience and it would be a success. But I'm probably wrong, but that doesn't make me any less certain.
Yeah, and going back to what you were saying about how you can't really create a sizzle reel for The Genius, I think that's why it is a cut above other shows. It allows itself to build these stories and to have these episodes which themselves are intended towards a certain outcome, right? You know when you watch an episode of The Genius, everything that I'm seeing now, I'm seeing for a reason. And that all of these moments play into this this larger narrative that at the end is going to be revealed for what it truly is. And so
they sometimes do.
Sure.
And then sometimes they play middle race and time comes to a halt.
The Genius at its best is like that.
Right? The Genius and at its best. Yeah.
You want to show off a show at its best. And it's hard to do that in a soundbite, right? For The Genius. Even those big reveals only are interesting in the context of everything that came before it. So there's no immediately engaging moment that you can show people and make them think, okay, I'm interested, I want to know more. You have to just sit them in a room for an hour, give them the first episode of The Genius, and then let it happen. Which if it's a network executive who you're struggling to get even 5 minutes of their time, that's just never going to come together.
Not going to come together. But I will say, just to kind of tie it in with what we were kind of talking about in a previous beat, in that the environment, I do feel like the environment of Society Games, Survivor, you know, they're Big Brother, a show I don't watch, but I understand that the game terrain, the habitat, is an important part of it. And I do sometimes, when I'm trying to fall asleep at night, think about, you know, the American Genius that I would make and if there's something I could do to make that pitch meeting go better. And I have some ideas about casting that I'm going to actually keep a little close to the vest.
Okay.
But I have... what I don't have, I think, is a good idea about that habitat, the game terrain. And I kind of feel like with the right pitch, that could get in the room. Like, actually, I hadn't told anybody about Survivor Fortress Escape until just this moment. And I think the fact that you have the visual frame of reference is Fort Boyard. But like, I loved your, you know, reaction. And I feel like if I had the right habitat to pitch the American Genius at, you know, it might just cause someone to prick up their ears. Like, the closest idea that I have, and I think it's far off, you know, just if I'm bearing my creative rough drafts, is that they would play the game in a special habitat, the interior of which, you know, resembles the Korean Genius, because we've got finite spaces, hidden cameras, nooks and crannies, and doors you can listen in on, books to hide notes in. But it's been built on the Google campus. And, you know, it's because it's like it's associated with, like, that's where the smarties are. So it's like, and, you know, you see the host, like, outside and, like, and inside our contestants are. And, you know, I guess, are they coming back every week or are they sleeping inside? But then when I think of other things, I'm like, and this is a really dopey idea. And I fully acknowledge that. But I think it's a picture, at least. And like I said, this is just something that, like, floats into my mind when I'm falling asleep at night, because I think about The Genius when I'm falling asleep at night. Specifically food chain. But it's like, what if you built a habitat, you know, kind of like Big Brother or The Genius, but it looks like an ice cave. It's a cave made out of ice, but the heat is turned up, so everybody's perspiring. Like, that's weird. Even saying it out loud is weird, but, like, I don't know. If that is, like, a flavor detail that adds to the pitch that's going to make somebody, like, prick up their ears. So what I'm trying to say is, like, I'm shopping around for what's the right environment, because ultimately it's a TV show. It's not a boxed game, though it would be pretty cool if it were. Although I guess there's a couple pieces of it that the great Scott created. But, you know, because it's a TV show, because it's a piece of visual art, where it's played matters. And I think that the society in Society Game works really well. You know, parts of it do not. Like, it wasn't until I saw somebody point out online, like, oh, you know, the interior of one is all made out of wood and the interior of the other is all made out of concrete. And, like, they otherwise mirror each other. But it's so subtle. Like, if it was Survivor, they would have it decked out in, like, all red on this side and all blue on this side. And there would never be a moment where you were uncertain about which society you were in. And I think that actually would have been a little bit better, because then it was kind of like watching a bunch of teens in, like, a dirty, just dirty stable.
Yeah, it is too subtle, and you don't really, there's no obvious visual motif for any of it. So if you had the viewers look away for a second, and then each tribe or each team, like, moved around one spot in the cycle, I don't think anyone would really notice, right? Like,
they built this great structure, but then when it came time, it's like they spent all their money on the house, and when it came time to furnish it, they, like, really, it seemed like they cut corners, you know, like with the ring toss 2 feet off the ground, and there was another prop that just seemed really cheap. The treadmill that broke. There were parts of it that I think suffered from being cheap. Dom, I'm going to make a suggestion. What if we kind of do, like, lightning round a few more non-spoiler matters related to Society Game, and then maybe do this the spoiler break? Because, I'll go to bed at some point.
Yeah, certainly. I was going to say one example of, I think, the setting really playing a big part in a way that's done very well is Whodunit. Right, where you have Rue Manor providing the perfect backdrop for the premise of that show, and you fall asleep at night thinking about The Genius, and I do as well. But sometimes Whodunit creeps in there and competes for my headspace.
Well, you know what, Dom? When the time is right, let's you and me do a shared Whodunit rewatch. I would love to return to Rue Manor and Giles and see it, knowing the outcome. And I gotta put The Quest up there with Whodunit as, like, noble experiments, and I would, like, to me, I think they both turned out to be very good TV. You know, not perfect, but I miss when ABC was taking big chances on series like that every summer. I'd love to see that come back.
Yeah, there are so many shows out there which had the good fortune to somehow be created, be in existence for one or two seasons, and then we know are never coming back, and it's tragic that they are never coming back, but just having had the chance to watch them for the little time that they were there, you know, they really added something to the whole TV landscape.
Also in that category, and at this point, you know, anybody listening, you probably have a pretty good idea of what my tastes are, and they might line up with your tastes. So I would also say search YouTube for Million Dollar Mind Game, which was a quiz show on ABC that for, I think, about like 6 episodes, and they aired it against football and didn't advertise it. They wanted this show to die. That's how good it is. And also Grand Slam, which I believe was an early Game Show Network competition show. These things are just catnip to me.
Yeah, well, we're definitely eager to have you on at any point when you're willing to talk about any of those. I think there's a ton of ground to cover there. Let's set that up for sure. Let's get onto that Society Game lightning round, though. Do you have anything in mind that you wanted to focus on?
There's one reward that they win, and we've seen them win rewards of cheeseburgers and other things, and they win a reward that is Samgyeopsal, and I, you know, my pronunciation is what it is, not good. I know that because I, like, rewound it and did a freeze frame, because they freaked out. Like, the reaction from the contestants when they told them they were going to win Samgyeopsal was bigger than any reward or any other reaction that we'd seen all along. And I was like, what's that? And it's a kind of Korean barbecue. So I went out and I ate it, and it is delicious. So everybody should eat Samgyeopsal.
Okay, I wasn't expecting it to go there, but sure, fair enough.
Other cast standouts besides MJ, there's a fellow who becomes leader of the Dictatorship Society pretty early on who is a comic. He's a great character. I guess maybe we can revisit him more in the spoilers. And can you help me remember who's the guy I'm thinking of who gets switched over to the other society and ends up making an alliance with MJ and they become like the most rootable duo? You know who I'm talking about?
Was it? I guess we are officially in the spoiler zone now for people who are following along. Is it Oliver we're thinking of?
No, it's not. No. Oliver is the other person who gets switched. Yeah. But it's not Macho. Macho is really good TV. He's very entertaining because he makes mistakes constantly.
Oh, Asol, we're thinking of.
It's Athol, yeah.
Which, I mean, Athol. Got to be careful about the diction there. Not firing any shots at him, but.
Otherwise, you'll accidentally say asshole.
Yes. That would be the punchline. He and MJ are a really interesting. Would you call them a study in contrast? Because they're certainly an interesting partnership, but I get the sense their personalities are not the most like overlapping, if you see what I mean.
To me, they were just like it was like a Lex and Big Tom situation. Like they're friends, like and you know, thank God for casting so that they got to like meet a friend. You know, seemed pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. I know that the main focus of the spoiler section is going to be just talking about MJ and our love for her. So let's just dive right into that if you like. So the thing that stood out to me is we spoke about in the context of The Genius how the cultural differences between a lot of Western societies and between South Korea can be reflected in the type of shows that you see, not only the type of shows that you see in the first place, but also how people behave in the context of those shows. And one good example is the kind of different leadership styles and how gendered expectations come into that as well. And I think...
Oh, yeah. That is so disappointing about the Korean shows. And make no mistake, Western TV has a long way to go in representations of women and casting of women and generally the way we treat women outside of television, but I do view the Korean shows as being even like more upsetting from that perspective than ours.
Yeah, I think that there's a temptation when our only exposure or our primary exposure to South Korean society is through the lens of a great work of art like The Genius to romanticize it and only focus on the bits which are able to lead to The Genius being produced and not to some of the kind of more the underlying stuff that's more questionable, but I think you do see glimpses of it both on The Genius and on Society Game. And I wonder if MJ was able to succeed because she has what I think would be regarded as a more kind of masculine leadership style, right, where she is more reserved.
I guess she's an athlete, and maybe I guess what you're saying is that some of the men fail to put the same kind of expectations on her that they might put on a woman who is, externally more demonstrative of what they think are feminine traits. I mean, I couldn't say if MJ is, amazing because she's more masculine than some other women. All I know is that she is great. gender is a continuum and a construct, and MJ is by any measure a all-star reality TV contestant. But yes, maybe part of the reason why she's able to flourish in the society, within the society game, is because, she doesn't exist within what might resemble like a traditional a gender binary as opposed to a, more contemporary continuum.
Yeah, well, that's why I think MJ kind of goes down so well with a Western audience. Yeah, she's not the most dynamic in confessional. She's not a big dramatic personality. Like, she's not Macho, right? She's not Dongmin. She's not going to be lighting out the screen. But just her kind of authoritative presence is what is really engaging about her and is what I think allows her to keep everyone else out there in line and under her leadership.
See, I think MJ's confessional is boffo. I think she does light up the screen. I think her personality, it sparkles. I think that part of what she's able to do as she influences and seduces the other players is due to her magnetism, which I think radiates through the screen. I remember confessionals where, as this competition goes on, MJ is more often called upon to deliver in the mental challenges, and she expresses some self-doubt at times. And then when she succeeds, she is appropriately celebrated by her team and appropriately basks in her success. And that may have to do with her athletic training, that she doesn't go, oh, you know, like, you know, when we hear, you know, accomplished women, you know, there's some time you're more likely to hear women say, oh, you know, well, it was a joint effort and that's all well and good, but you're more likely to hear players, you know, like survivor players talk about how great they are a lot of the time if they're men. And MJ doesn't demonstrate like false confidence, but when she nails it in a challenge, particularly when she's having to compete in a mental capacity, and she, you know, surprises herself, you know, she talks about that. And I know that she is, you know, she gets emotional during some of the later eliminations, and we get to see her tender side as well. I mean, I would, for my money, I think that she's the whole package. You know, Macho is great because he is so comically inept, like to the point where he continues to get flustered when people name him as being the person who loses the challenge, when he loses the challenge time after time. Like that's comical. But yeah, MJ, you know, whether it's, I think editing probably plays a part in it, although they didn't seem to edit much out. So I feel like we saw a lot of what MJ, what MJ had to offer.
We saw the entire like 24 hours of each day, you know, broadcast on the screen. I do wonder if there's something about African culture as well, because I know on The Genius, even a lot of the more kind of narcissistic or arrogant guys, they never really took credit for stuff in the same way. It was there's always like this self-effacing tinge to it.
Yes. Yeah. We do see that, and it does. I love that it's like a window into another culture. I find it broadening, and you know, I joke about some Gyeop Seol, but you know, I'm watching the episodes and I'm learning about the, you know, the pronouns or, you know, how they talk to each other. I'm like, ooh, I never knew that. Facet of the language.
The honorifics, like Young, Nuna.
The honorifics. And, you know, I'm an American, so I'm very provincial and very, you know, narcissistic, and I don't know, you know, a lot about other parts of the world. And so watching these shows, which is, you know, purely for my entertainment, the fact that it's also broadening, I really appreciate it. Like it's there's a bit of enrichment there as well as, you know, entertainment.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, as you say, you're eager to get to bed. But before you do, and before thoughts of The Genius start swirling around your mind, what further thoughts do you have on the Society Game before we get you out of here?
Yeah, I'm not ready to tap out just yet. Because I think that, so just as there's a parallelism in the structure of the Society Game, there's a parallelism in the way that the episodes as an engaging TV series fall short. Because on the one hand, we have MJ and her society, you know, growing together and flourishing and making discoveries about themselves. And then on the other side, you have the much more stagnant dictatorship society, which is largely dominated by the married guy who is the best at the mental challenges. And since all the challenges are equal part, you know, all have physical dexterity and mental, and there's nobody on MJ's side who is as good mentally as that guy, they just keep getting shellacked. And the outcome, you know, the underdog loses. And so it would be like if you had, you know, when we're in the challenge room talking about Survivor, we sometimes use James Clement as an example of like, well, this is a player who's able to manifest so much strength that nobody else will ever come close. So is this a challenge where it's going to be broken if James is in it? So in the same way, this married guy, who they get a lot of comic mileage about the story of him and his wife, you know, but he's kind of a sad sack and he whines a lot about wanting to be the leader. And then the guy who's the leader of his society for the whole back half, he sucks. I hated that guy. I wanted so much for him to get his comeuppance, and they won and MJ lost and stunk. You know, what are you going to do? So, I mean, that was the demise. There was one player who was so bright that nothing else really mattered. He was so good in the mental challenges that basically Athol couldn't out-treadmill his mental ability. And the whole show, you know, hinged on that. And that's fair. The best player won. But it didn't make – there was no way that they could make – there was no way they could make the audience root for MJ to lose.
Yeah, and you do wonder if Madong had chosen differently when it came down to Kyungho versus Haesung in that struggle you mentioned of who is the better mental player to take us forward into the finals. You wonder if MJ and her team would have had a better chance, but it is an issue, I think, that when you frame the show as being about, well, we're going to test every facet of your skills. We're going to have physical challenges and mental challenges and dexterity challenges. If there is any kind of imbalance towards any one of those, then the game becomes so heavily lopsided that it's hard to keep it going.
Yeah, and I think that that's really a design flaw. Here's a fun story for anybody who's listened this far in. Like my first time in the Survivor Challenge Room, we kind of looked through the dead letter office, like challenges that were pitched and even had an illustration drawn, but were never going to go anywhere. And there was an endurance challenge. And keep in mind, the first season that I worked on,